Accession number 19816, Reel 2.
William Rhodes Jones, Reel 2.
One more point about that incident was, we were told to withdraw back through the village to join the battalion headquarters. And when we got back, my orderly tapped me on the shoulder and I looked round, and there were loud explosions going off from where we'd come from, black smoke going up in the air, and a shell fire and bombardment had taken place. So we only escaped Japanese retribution by about 10 minutes. Now the next move after that was we carried on further south towards Schwebern, and of course by that time the rest of the brigade and other units were approaching Schwebo from the north, and we were given the job of moving round mainly now through open paddy fields with the odd scrub here and there, an encircling movement east of the Schwebo. And we were told, well, it's on the way, we did ambush one group of about 30 Japanese and killed most of them. They didn't know we were there. But going further around, we established a roadblock south of Schwebo by a culvert. And we had machine guns pointing down the road, mortars ready to fire, and night time came, and we heard the padding of troops coming down the road. And this Japanese group of about 40, I suppose, 50 perhaps, were allowed right into the position till they reached battalion headquarters, and then the machine guns opened up and people either side opened up, and we killed about, I know we killed 38 plus. Because as they leapt off the road, they leapt onto us. Mortars opened fire further up the road, but of course that gave our position away, and any Japanese who were following dispersed across country and ran through the paddy fields and away from us. There was some criticism of people saying, well, why didn't we kill more? But the fact is, you can't kill more that come into the bag. And it was really quite successful. Schwebo was then captured and of course became the main base for the continuation of the 14th Army advance. And as a result, Dakotas were now coming in one after the other, bringing supplies in. And unfortunately, and we saw it happen, some Japanese fighters came and shot down, I think, 5 Dakotas altogether. Before they left, and a few minutes later, our own Thunderbolts or something like them came over and followed the Japs up, but they'd done the damage. They managed to nip in, and yet there was American anti-aircraft fire there, but they nipped in without being noticed. Now, our next move was the main crossing of the Irrawaddy. That was a very big obstacle, and it was decided that we would cross east of Schwebo, let's say the whole division, at a place called Chokmyong. So we moved away from Schwebo towards that crossing, that place, and prepared to go over. Can I have a rest there? The crossing was first to cross were the Recce battalion of the division, which were the 15th Punjabis, and they sent a patrol to find out whether there were any Japs immediately on the other side, and then followed up with their battalion, and then the rest of us, our battalion, followed them in the middle of the night. White tapes were made so we could follow white tapes down to the edge of the Chindwin. And I might say the General Pete Reese was there, chivying us along and giving assistance. And we got into small assault boats. I suppose there must have been, perhaps they took about 10 people, and were paddled across. Now the Brahmaputra, which is the river, was about half a mile wide there, but not flowing all that fast. And we got across all that in that night, the whole lot of us, without mules, of course. And next morning we started to make contact with the Japanese. That side of the Brahmaputra, the jungle was really mostly bamboo jungle, rather thick bamboo jungle. And Japanese patrols were beginning to find us, and we were finding them as well. And odd scattered engagements took place. What was then decided was that the division would form a bridgehead, but that we were to go about 2 miles further into the country and occupy a hill called Minbantong, which was a big, rocky, jungle-covered, quite a big hill, which rather dominated the area. It was about 2 miles away. I suppose time had elapsed sufficiently for ferrying mules across, because we started off with mules, and we went through all this bamboo jungle, arrived at Minbantong, found it was occupied by some Japanese, shot them off it, and took over. There happened to be a well there. Took over a position on the top of Minbantong, along the spur. Japs reacted fairly sharply, and there was a sort of firefight went on. It was impossible to dig in there because it's absolute rock, and all the men could do was to form sort of parapets out of stone. Anyway, that night, or the night afterwards, after several other engagements around and about, the Japanese made a really determined attack in the night. And in fact, one of our leading sections, a Japanese officer did get into it and killed one or two men with his sword before he was dispatched. And then we also had the support of the mountain batteries way back by the river. They were positioned somewhere by the Irrawaddy. So the mountain guns had actually ranged on the ridge beyond us, and they then plonked down shell after shell, and the Japanese attack faded away. Now, after that, we then went nearer the bridgehead and took up a position near a little village called Yeshin. Now, Yeshin was on a track leading from the main Japanese position to the bridgehead. It was a very sensitive place because that's where all their supplies came through. We weren't actually on the track, but we were near it by some river, by a little stream, and the Japs didn't like that at all. And this time, they actually used artillery on us, which we were dug in, and so there weren't a lot of casualties, but those who suffered most were the mules, because you can't dig mules in. And I always had a tremendous admiration for mules, especially when they were being shelled, when we were being shelled, because they were wounded, some very often severely, and even killed, and there was never any panic. They just stood there. However, after the shelling, the Japanese made another concerted attack in the middle of the night, led by an officer in a t-shirt and a band round his head and a sword. The bravery of the Japanese officer is absolutely extraordinary. But I did feel that once the officer was killed, and he was usually the nearest corpse to us in the morning, once the officers were killed, the rest of them didn't seem to have the same enthusiasm. And that was the same on Minbantong, and it was the same there. Anyway, we had quite a lot. We ambushed quite a few Japs moving down the track from by Yeshin, and then the order came for us to rejoin the main force at the bridgehead. But of course, the Japanese had more or less encircled the area of the bridgehead, and so we had to fight our way back, and the leading company, D Company, led by Major Patterson, who became General Patterson later, had about 12 casualties, several killed, attacking Japs who were on the perimeter of the bridgehead. However, we got through in the morning and returned there. The bridgehead itself had suffered attack after attack by Japanese. Sikh machine gunners had done noble work, but it was a fairly tense situation before we'd got enough troops over. However, they held out, and the Baluchis particularly held out brilliantly on Pear Hill, which was a big hill at one side of the bridgehead. And more supplies gradually came over, and more troops, and even tanks were brought over, and the moment came when we had to break out from the bridgehead, and that was done southwards towards Singu. Our battalion was detailed to capture Singu, which is a sort of fairly big town on the edge of the Irrawaddy. And we tried it in the evening, I remember, with the Stuart tanks. But the Japanese, as they were battened down, the Japanese found that if they shot at the periscopes, that they could blind the tanks, which they did. And that wasn't a very successful attack. The next morning, we attacked again with tanks, and this time we got through to Singu and cleared it. So we moved down the river to a place called Thule, was it? Wait a minute, I can't quite remember. Thule was one other place, which was dive-bombed by our planes before we got there. Unfortunately, one of the bombs went off before it was released from the plane, and we saw this wretched plane blow up in midair. After that, we were told to occupy a village called Kanpa, which was off the main line of the river bank and more inland. We did this by going through, we knew there were some Japs there, but we did this by going through a roundabout and very thick patch of thorny jungle, and got there to occupy it against relatively small resistance. Although once we got there, and it had a punji chong in the middle, which was a wooden temple which the Buddhist priests used, and a sort of parapet round it, and we occupied that, and we were shot at from across the paddy fields. But fortunately, we did have time to dig in, because we had then a tremendous bombardment started. 150 millimeters, 105s, battalion guns firing across the paddy fields at point blank range. And it really was a tremendous bombardment. And some people say it's the worst that happened in that war, because it was terribly concentrated, very accurate. Our pioneer platoon got a direct hit, and their explosives blew up, and that was the end of them. And we had two officers killed, and 20 or more men. And the whole place was covered in dust from the result of the shelling, and you couldn't see anything. And we thought there was going to be an attack. But fortunately, they didn't attack. And we survived. After that, next morning, we made our way back a little. I can't quite remember what happened then, but certainly the Japs didn't attack, although they really had us in a very poor, bad position. That was the action at Camp Kampa. Our next action was at a place called Miniwa. And this was quite different. We had, my company was one of the leading companies, and we had big tanks. I think they must have been Grants. And I can't remember what regiment, maybe the Gordons or somebody like that. We formed up on the start line, and the Japs started shelling us on the start line, which is very disconcerting. However, we moved forward, and the operation went in three stages, Freeman, Hardy, and Willis. And when we got to about Hardy, well, I rode on the tank to start with, to see what was going on, but bullets started bouncing off it, so I got off. And when we got to Hardy, we found Japs dug in on fairly open ground, but the tanks somehow hypnotized them. And one found this, and I heard this from some people who remarked on that at Mike Tiller, how when big tanks approach, the Japs just sort of lay low. Anyway, they lay low, and my men sorted them out on the ground, and I ran across and told the tank commander to stop a while we just cleared them. And then my left-hand forward platoon discovered two battalion guns were behind a sort of ridge. And so the right-hand platoon commander, Dunbahada, he was a marvelous man, rushed forward and grabbed a machine gun, eliminated all the crew, and captured the guns. The Jap gunners, some of them weren't even armed, which I thought was a great, very extraordinary thing to be. And some of them, the local scrub seemed to get on fire. I don't know why. And some of them came out with their clothing and on fire, and I'm afraid I had to shoot one of them who rushed towards me. And it was quite an exciting do, but in some ways the Japanese were cowed by the tanks. Anyway, we captured the village eventually and prepared to move on as the main track passed through there.
Did the Gurkhas use their kukris in that engagement?
No, I didn't see them use their kukris. The next stage of the proceedings, as far as our battalion is concerned, was movement south towards Mandalay. Of course, I'm only giving what I saw. There were other operations going on. And at this time, there was some sort of tank force that had been arranged, which was to go down the banks of the Irrawaddy, and was called Stiletto, Operation Stiletto, where they were going to sort of do a very forceful push. We couldn't do that, but we advanced south, and we had a battle at a place called Shwepi, where I was wounded, and unfortunately Mike Cowan, who was General Cowan's son, was wounded on this hill and died later in hospital. We were following up the Japs, but they were withdrawing. After producing quite a lot of resistance, they withdrew towards Mandalay.
How did you come to be wounded yourself?
Well, I was on the road, and it was sort of scrub jungle, and we were advancing up the road, trying to find out where they were, and a lot of bullets flying about, and they fired, they have a sort of grenade thing which fires things that looked like a shell, but in fact are sort of big grenades. One landed on the road near me and caught me here.
On the forehead.
And blood came into my eyes, and I thought, oh my God, all the rest of it. But in fact, it didn't penetrate the skull. Which reminds me of this mark on my chin was from a shell splinter in Kanpur, but nothing serious. What I suddenly began to realize there, though, was when the Japanese withdrew, they always fired very long bursts with their machine gun. And luckily, they were always shot too high. But it was a signal, which I couldn't take advantage of again, that they were on the way, that they were retreating. They moved back towards Mandalay, and of course we approached Mandalay, and Mandalay Hill was taken by the 3rd, 4th Gurkhas and the Berkshires, and we didn't have any immediate operations in front of Mandalay. The general decided that he would try and knock down the walls with a medium machine guns firing open sights. That wasn't very successful because, in fact, it was really a mound of earth and with a little bit of wall stuck on top, so you couldn't breach it very easily. And then Mitchell bombers came over to try and bomb the walls, create an opening. And there again, it was quite pointless, and also it was unfortunate because one or two of their bombs went too far and landed in the Worcesters, killing quite a few people. So our next job was to move round the west side of Mandalay and into the streets there, which we did. And that led to sort of scrappy street fighting between houses in the streets, across streets. And there were attempts to make coordinated attacks, but they didn't really get very far. There was even an idea that the general, who was always one for doing the dashing thing, decided that we should row across the little moat, scale the walls, and crash into the compound of the palace. But they found that the moat was so weedy that you couldn't really get anything across it anyway. And luckily, they changed their minds. Anyway, in the middle of the night, suddenly, we saw the palace go up in flames, King Thibaw's palace. My grandfather, who, as I said, had been a barrister out there, had written a story about how King Thibaw decided on helping the British rather than the French when Burma was annexed. And so I was rather... It was rather interesting to see the palace go up in flames like that. And then about a night or two later, we heard a train chugging out of the south end of Mandalay. I think it was, what was the name? Arva, the fortress. And they disappeared southwards. Now, the next phase, we were given a bit of a rest. The Japs moved south and were being dealt with by other people. And we eventually got down to Mike Tiller, which of course had already been captured by that move across country with 17 Div, with Punch Khan. And we went down to Mike Tiller and had a few days rest there. We bathed in the lake in the middle of near the town. And relaxed. Next, we went south towards Pinmanar and Tongu. And I'm a bit vague about what happened here. There was a place called Tazi. And I remember going up, for some unknown reason, I was made to go up, join the Americans at an airfield, get into a Mitchell bomber, go up with them, and then the Mitchell bombers had a cannon in front. And we approached the hillside, jungle hillside, and shot shells into it. I don't think it did any good, but I can't understand how I got there and what was watching these extraordinary proceedings. Our next main operation was fighting up to Kalor. Now, Kalor was a hill station several thousand feet up, and the road leading to it was an absolute serpentine zigzag of hairpins through jungle-covered hills up to Kalor. Kalor was a hill station with lovely English houses and a sort of English atmosphere. But we had to get there first. And as we approached what we call the staircase, the serpentine road, we were shelled by Japanese who could look right down on us. And it was decided that our battalion would do an encirclement and take up a position on the on the road above the worst part of the hairpins. Now, this involved an operation which took us 2 days. We had to go up a very steep, in a very deep gorge, and jungle was getting thick here. And then we had to climb really precipitous hills, with jungle-covered hills. We got halfway up before dark, and of course we couldn't sleep because it was difficult enough just to, not to slide down. And the men were carrying mortars, 3-inch mortars and mortar bombs. I think only Gurkhas could have done that. It was quite extraordinary, the amount of weight they were carrying, and they got them up these precipitous hills. And eventually, the next day, we got to the top, and it became a bit clearer there. And we found a spur overlooking the road, and we went down and occupied that, my company being on the edge of the spur, looking down the road, and the other companies, one on top of the hill, and the others around and about. I don't know quite how we could have done any real damage to the Japanese. The only thing we could do was to stop them taking guns, vehicles, or anything up the road. But what happened was that that a couple of Japanese started up the road towards us, and one of my riflemen had a shot at them. They turned tail, of course, weren't hit, and again yelling and shouting to their friends down the road, who suddenly realized that there was somebody, some enemy ahead, and started to mortar us and shell us, thinking we might be just sort of guerrillas. Then our mortars opened up onto where they were very effectively, and so there could not be any more movement up that road at all, and no Japs attempted it. They must have found another way round through the jungle and left behind guns and what vehicles they had. So they withdrew round us and up towards Kalor. We moved on the edge of the road towards Kalor, and we had contact on more than one occasion with the Japanese, but nothing serious, until finally Kalor was captured with us and the rest of the brigade, and with the help of some tanks.